Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the Lead Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 12, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Pietra Rivoli, a professor at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University, where she teaches finance and international business in the undergraduate, graduate, and executive programs. The topic of her talk will be, Who's Afraid of International Trade? The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.M. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Lloyd Ambrosius, Samuel Clark Waugh Distinguished Professor of International Relations and a Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
This evening's lecture, Who's Afraid of International Trade, by Professor Pietra Rivoli, is also a Lewis Harris Lecture on Public Policy. The Harris Lecture on Public Policy was created to examine major public policy issues and to provide a special opportunity for interaction between students, the business community, and the academic community in Nebraska. The annual Lewis E. Harris Lecture on Public Policy was endowed by the Smith Klein Corporation to honor its former chairman, the late Lewis E. Harris, founder of the Harris Laboratories, one of the world's leading independent scientific testing and research laboratories. Professor Rivoli is on the faculty at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University, where she teaches finance and international business. Her book, The Travels of a T-Shirt in the Global Economy, has been widely acclaimed as a path-breaking study of globalization. After her lecture, you will have the opportunity to ask questions of our speaker by writing them on cards provided by the ushers. Now join me in welcoming Professor Rivoli to Nebraska.
Thank you so much for inviting me back to Nebraska. It's actually my second time here at the University of Nebraska to come and talk about topics related to my book, and I'm just delighted to be here on this very, very beautiful day. It's a little bit hard for me to see you, but I can see we have a lot of people out there, and in economics, when you have a lot of people in the audience, what we just assume is that the tickets must have been very cheap, okay? So thank you all very much for coming. Okay. In about 2 weeks, we're going to have some distinguished guests visit us in Washington, D.C. They come about every 6 months for the semi-annual meetings of the officials of the World Bank and the IMF. Okay. You never quite know in Washington what's going to happen at these meetings. Starting about 12 years ago, they started to become a lot more exciting. Okay? About in 1999, okay, a big rash of anti-globalization protests started to accompany these meetings every 6 months or so. And about probably the last one was maybe in 2008 or 2009, every couple of years, these protests would kind of flare up again. Okay? A couple of times, the anti-globalization protests surrounding these meetings were actually big enough to bring the entire meeting to a halt, and the delegates had to turn around and go home. Okay? In the early years of the anti-globalization protests, these protests weren't just taking place in Washington. They were taking place all around the world. Okay? We had them in Milan and in Tokyo and in Seoul, Korea, and in Rio de Janeiro. Okay? All of this was part of a very far-flung yet pretty well-coordinated movement that has come to be known as the anti-globalization movement. Okay. Now, I have, I'm old enough to have lived through a number of activist movements, and I think what is interesting about the anti-globalization movement is that it's hard to say in succinct words what exactly the protesters are opposed to. Okay? So, for example, a couple of years later, on Georgetown University campus, we had an anti-war protest when the U.S. invaded Iraq. And it's very clear, as you listen to those protesters, what it was they were opposed to. They were opposed to the U.S. military presence in Iraq. Okay? The anti-globalization protest, it did not have a concise thing that people were against. It was a very diverse. Again, it was very far-flung. It was all over the place, both in terms of geography as well as topic. Now, the anti-globalization protests took particular root on college campuses, including here at the University of Nebraska, and including my own university, Georgetown University. And it was these protests that gave rise to my book, The Travels of a T-Shirt in the Global Economy. Because one day, I was walking back to my office in 1999, and I found the entrance to my office building blocked by a protest. So I couldn't actually get into my building, and so I stopped to listen to what was going on. What the students were protesting at the time, and again, because the anti-globalization movement was so broad, this particular group of students was protesting against outsourcing and international trade in the apparel industry as it applied to our university-licensed apparel. So you have T-shirts that say Nebraska across the front, and we have T-shirts that say Georgetown. That apparel is licensed apparel. That is, you know, people pay to be able to put those words on the T-shirt. Okay? And the student protesters were saying, wait a minute, if you're going to put the word Georgetown across the front of this T-shirt, then we want some assurances and safeguards put in place that this apparel was not produced in sweatshops. And they had a vision, if you will, in their heads about the conditions under which apparel was produced in our new global economy. And this movement became known as kind of it was a subset of the anti-globalization movement, and it became known as the anti-sweatshop movement. One thing led to another that day, and the students ended up occupying the university president's office. And they refused to leave until the university agreed to address some of their demands and their concerns. Okay. Now, if you know anything about universities, you know the way we address anything is that we form a committee. Okay. And so while the students were taking the president's office hostage, the university's first response is, calm down, we'll form a committee. Okay. And sure enough, they formed a committee, and I was appointed to this committee. Now, we started this dialogue with the students having very clear ideas about the injustices out there in the world. And they had kind of a movie reel in their head about the awful conditions under which this clothing was being produced. They had movies in their head of unsafe conditions, of unclean conditions, of low wages, of child labor, so forth and so on. And these were the conditions under which Georgetown apparel was being produced, they said. Now, of course, my response back to them was, well, how do you know that? You know, how do you know that? Okay. Well, they didn't really know, but they had heard about these things. Okay. And here was my problem. I didn't really know either. So I was in no position to counter this or to support it or to say anything much at all about it because I had a very extensive academic background in the field of international trade. I knew a lot about how the global economy worked, but if you're actually talking about the nitty-gritty of conditions in an apparel factory, well, of course, I had no idea. And so this ignorance on my part, okay, was actually what led me to write this book, The Travels of a T-Shirt in the Global Economy, because I decided that in order to have an intelligent conversation, I needed to have some firsthand knowledge of what was actually going on. So I began to investigate the life story of this simple T-shirt, and my objective was not just to learn about the conditions in the factories. My objective was to kind of ask the question, well, how can the life story of this very, very simple product inform our discussions and our debates about globalization? Okay. And so I investigated this life story. The life story of my T-shirt is very much a global story. This is a T-shirt I bought for about $5 in Florida. Okay. It was born in West Texas near Lubbock, which is the global center of the cotton agricultural industry in the world today. Okay. So just as you have in Nebraska a very high concentration of corn and soy and wheat, in West Texas, it's even more concentrated because pretty much all there is, for a variety of reasons, is cotton. Okay. And so I spent time in West Texas learning about the global cotton industry. This cotton for my T-shirt was then shipped to China, okay, where it was spun into yarn and knit into fabric and ultimately turned into a T-shirt. Okay. And so I next spent time in China to learn about the next step in this value chain, which is the global textile and apparel industry. Okay. Once the cotton is transformed into a T-shirt, it, of course, came back to the United States. This is a very interesting part of the story, because you think of this part as being simple. You know, the T-shirt just gets on a boat and comes back to the U.S. But actually, it's a very complicated journey, because in order to get goods back into the United States, especially from China, the goods have to navigate very complex U.S. and international trade rules and trade policies. So part of the study was about the politics behind these trade flows. Okay. Ultimately, most of the clothing that you and I purchase in the U.S. is donated to Salvation Army or to Goodwill or something like that. And once it's donated, it gives rise to yet another global industry, and that is the industry in used and recycled textiles. Okay. And what I learned is that, as most of you out there, I can see there's a lot of T-shirts out there. We were talking about this at lunch today. Most of us in the United States have way too many T-shirts, right? Okay. And so every year, maybe your mom says, hey, give me some of those T-shirts, I'll take them to Goodwill. Okay. Now, from an economic perspective, if we all have too much of something, that's what we would call a surplus. Okay. And if I have too many T-shirts, old T-shirts, and you have too many old T-shirts, then we're not going to buy each other's old T-shirts. Okay. And so in a country like the United States, you have a surplus of something like used clothing. Okay, in a global economy, that surplus will tend to find a home, okay, in a place where there's a shortage. Okay. In particular, in the United States, warm weather clothing, such as T-shirts, tends to find its way to the markets in Africa. Okay. And this is another very, very interesting industry, the way this clothing is collected and sorted and graded and sold. Okay. So here you have it, the life story of my T-shirt. Okay. And again, my idea was to just ask what this simple product could teach us about globalization. Okay. Now, the first edition of this book was published in 2005, and the second one in 2009. Okay. One of the things that I did remember very well was the very strong anti-globalization sentiment that was kind of pervading the news as you watch these protests and so forth from the early days of the decade. But after my book was published, I wasn't quite prepared for the very strong negative reactions that this seemed to cause in people. Okay. To someone like myself, who comes out of a business and economics background, if I were looking at this picture, I think most people coming out of backgrounds like mine would say, well, that's a happy picture. Okay. That's a happy picture because it shows trade flows. It shows globalization, and trade and globalization is sent essentially to somebody from economics is a story of creation. Okay? If we are trading these goods back and forth across borders, we are creating jobs, we are creating wealth, we are creating production. So this is essentially a happy story that we're showing up here. Okay? Now, this looks much different than a T-shirt produced as recently as about 1990. Okay? If we go back to 1990 and we say, well, what would a typical picture look like for the life story of a T-shirt produced in 1990? It was much more typical to have all of this activity confined to a relatively small part of the United States, and that would be the South. So we'd have cotton production in Texas, we'd have textile production in North Carolina, we'd have apparel assembly and sewing in Alabama, and we'd have used clothing donated to Goodwill and then would find its way to less fortunate people here in the United States. So instead of these lines going all around the world, as recently as 1990, this was a tiny little picture. Okay? And this is what bothered people. This was what was generating the strong reaction, the idea that it was a negative development for the story of this T-shirt to go from taking up a small piece of the map to a very big piece of the map. Okay. What I had thought was that the anti-globalization protest was sort of a almost a fringe movement, if you will. Okay. I had thought that these were college students, these were activists, okay? These weren't people that you run into on so-called Main Street, okay? But what I learned as I traveled around talking about this book was that the negative connotations, the negative reactions to globalization were not at the fringes of American society. They were very much on Main Street, okay? And what I was picking up from audiences as I talked about this book was confirmed by a lot of political poll data and a lot of survey data. So for example, in 2002, almost 80% of Americans had a very favorable or somewhat good view of international trade. This went down to as low as about 52% in 2008 and bounced back some, according to the recent survey. But we look now at the current popular opinion, and this is saying 66%, two-thirds of Americans, have a favorable view of trade. Well, to someone from a background such as mine, that's very surprising because it means that one-third of Americans are negatively disposed to the very idea of international trade and globalization. The other thing that the survey data finds is that we are more negative about international trade than citizens of just about any other industrialized country, more negative than Japan, more negative than Germany, more negative than Italy, more negative than Brazil, and so forth and so on. Okay. So what I encountered then was kind of a very broad-based sense of pessimism about international trade. Now, as I started to investigate and think about this more and more, of course, I realized that anti-trade sentiment has a very long and illustrious history. Early Christians, with very few exceptions, were very opposed to international trade and wanted to keep their economies very local. The ancient Greeks were also very reticent about international trade. Now, these groups had different reasons. The Christians, in many cases, were opposed to commerce sort of generally, and international trade was a particular version of commerce. Trade and money-making were thought to be kind of evil activities. The ancient Greeks, on the other hand, they were opposed to trade because they valued the ideal of self-sufficiency. They thought we should all kind of be taking care of ourselves. So all of this is to say that while in 1999, what looked like a kind of a snapshot event, this anti-globalization movement, it first appeared to me that this was a kind of a phenomenon that was limited both in terms of its point in time and in terms of how many people agreed with this view. But really what I learned was that this pessimism or this wariness, if you will, about international trade has a very long history, and it also has a very strong hold on American public opinion. Okay. Now, this leads to the question, why such long and steadfast objections? Or in other words, as I titled this talk tonight, who's afraid of international trade? Well, as you probably know, there's a sharp divide on the topic of trade if you put economists in one category and the rest of the world in another category. Because almost without exception, economics views the free flow of goods and services across borders as the best economic policy for a country to follow. Okay. The economic case for free trade, and many of you have learned this in your economics classes, rests on the argument that the free exchange of goods and services across borders will result in higher incomes and higher economic growth. So if the object of the game is to have the highest level of economic activity, the highest rate of economic growth, then economists will tell you that free trade is demonstrably the best way to achieve this goal. Okay. Now, we have many, many volumes of research that confirm this conclusion. Okay. Countries with fewer barriers to international trade very clearly outperform those with high barriers. And the idea is a simple one. If we allow countries to specialize in goods and services where they have a comparative advantage, then free trade is a win-win. And it's almost by definition that free trade is good policy to economists, because we define good policy as that which leads to the highest level of economic performance. Okay? Now, free trade, of course, also produces losers as well as winners within a national economy. Okay? So in very broad terms, the state of Nebraska wins from international trade because Nebraska is such a big exporter to the rest of the world. Okay? Also in very broad terms, Michigan and Ohio tend to lose, because many of the industries that were dominant in Michigan and Ohio have now been really gutted by competition from abroad. Okay? So under a free trade regime, industries where we don't have a comparative advantage, such as steel or textiles or shoes, okay, will lose, okay, and we'll have unemployment in these sectors. Okay? So what will happen is that our country as a whole will become richer, but some firms and industries and individuals will lose. Okay? Traditionally, we believed that most of the objection to international trade, we thought that most of the complainers, if you will, most of the complaints were coming from those who got the short end of the stick, who were the losers in globalization. Because it made sense that if your factory in Michigan or Ohio closed because of cheaper imports from China, then you're going to be opposed to international trade. But if anti-trade sentiment in society is the result of all of those people who have been harmed by trade, then there's a relatively simple solution, okay? And that is that we need to protect the people who are harmed by trade or to compensate them, okay? In other words, if we can take the person in Ohio who's lost their job because of international trade and compensate them, maybe with retraining, maybe with extended employment benefits or health benefits or so forth, then maybe we can bring people more on board with a free trade agenda. Economists kind of believe that if you pay somebody enough, they'll change their mind. Okay. So this policy, compensate the losers, has been the cornerstone of U.S. policy since about the end of World War II. By extending all of these benefits and protections, okay, tax credits and health insurance, unemployment insurance, and so forth, the people who protest against trade could be kind of quieted down so that the rest of us could get on with what is clearly the best economic policy. Okay? I don't think it's quite that simple anymore, because as I've been talking about this book, really around the world, okay, one of the things that I've learned is that it's not only the losers from international trade who have concerns and objections. Okay? In fact, there's really very little doubt that the great, great majority of Americans are economic beneficiaries of international trade. Global competition is a huge boon for us. It brings us cheaper and better TVs and computers and cars and T-shirts. Many of us, of course, work for foreign companies, or we make a living selling products and services to the rest of the world. So you see the closed factory, or you see the people who have lost on the TV all the time. But in reality, the losers from international trade are far, far outnumbered by the winners. Okay? So I now think that this focus on the losers is missing, really, a wide range of objections to international trade and globalization. Some of these concerns are valid. Maybe some of them are not so valid, but they are all more complicated than the lost paycheck of a factory worker in Ohio. Okay. I think there are three categories of concerns that people have about international trade, in addition to the traditional concern of the laid-off factory worker. I think there are concerns about the future of our natural environment. I think there are concerns about the process by which goods are produced. And I think there are concerns about the fairness of our global trade regime. Okay. So I can be a beneficiary of international trade. I can be a winner while at the same time having concerns about these issues. Let's take the first one. Is international trade threatening the environment? Okay. Well, it seems like a logical concern. Okay. First of all, trade expands the scale of economic activity. So we have more production, we have more resources being consumed, we have more pollution, so forth and so on. Okay. Secondly, there's an awful lot of transportation involved compared to our story of 30 or so years ago, okay, when all of the T-shirts production was local. Okay. And finally, there is this idea that there's a sort of environmental race to the bottom in globalization today. So won't companies kind of pick their production location or choose to put their factories where environmental controls are the weakest? And so if companies are putting their production in the countries with the weakest controls, then isn't that in the long run damaging to the environment? Okay. Now, I think, fortunately, some emerging research suggests a more complicated picture. For example, it is free trade, after all, that allows environmentally friendly technologies to spread across borders. Okay. And it's also true that the richer people become from international trade or from any other source, the more they are willing to pay for clean air and water, the more they're willing to pay for environmental quality. So maybe actually the causality runs the other way, and maybe international trade and globalization is a help to the environment. Okay? I don't think we know the answer to the question right now. Okay? There is a lot of ongoing research, a lot of data to be sorted out. My point, however, is that these environmental concerns are not directly addressed by compensating factory workers who've lost their jobs. Okay? So if U.S. policy is simply to compensate the losers who have lost from globalization, then this leaves unaddressed the concerns of another segment of our citizens, which has to do with the future of the environmental viability of our planet. Okay? So if we're going to try to bring these folks on board with a free trade and globalization agenda, it's going to require very different policies than things like extending health insurance or job retraining, so forth and so on. The second concern that I have heard is that I think both businesses and consumers are increasingly concerned with what I think of as the process associated with making goods and services, in addition to the product that they're purchasing. If all I am worried about is getting the best product at the best price, the cheapest T-shirt or the best TV or what have you, then free trade is a very easy sell, because obviously it makes sense to have global competition. That is the best thing for a consumer. But if I'm not only concerned with the product attributes and the price of the product, I also have concerns about the process by which the goods are produced, then maybe I have a more complicated picture. Okay. I have an example of this from my visit to Nebraska. I'm staying just down the street. I don't know which way it is, but at the Embassy Suites. Okay. And they're nice enough to leave me coffee to make in the morning. Okay. And this morning when I woke up, I found this little card at the Embassy Suites next to my coffee. Okay. The card says, "Our coffee is strong enough to save the world." Okay. And then it goes on to say, "We're looking to make the world a better place by making the world a better cup of coffee. Traditional forested coffee farms are havens for wildlife. And now coffee lovers everywhere can support farmers who maintain these rainforest environments," so forth and so on. Okay. Why did they put this thing on my pillow? Okay. Well, someone made a judgment that people who stayed in the hotel cared about the process, right, of the production of this product. Okay. Somebody made that decision. Okay. And I think that it is true that increasingly both businesses and consumers do have process questions. Now, a big example of this was, of course, the anti-sweatshop protests of about 10 years ago. Okay. So if I am concerned about alleged sweatshop conditions in the production of my apparel or alleged damage to coffee-growing communities from the production of my coffee, then once again, okay, you are not going to be able to bring me on board with a free trade agenda simply by taking care of laid-off factory workers. Okay. Finally, in order to bring people on board with a free trade agenda, people have to believe that the system, if you want, for lack of a better word, is fair. Okay. And this is really interesting from the perspective of someone like myself with an academic background in economics. Because what the new research shows and this is even taking place in laboratories like neuroscience research. What it increasingly shows is that even though economists predict that we all want more and more and more and more, actually, we are also concerned, it appears maybe even at a cellular level, with whether the game we're playing is fair. And we will give up money. We will walk away from money if we don't think the game is fair. Okay. So not only can we not pay you enough to agree with us, okay, it's possible, okay, that you won't play at all, okay, in a game where you think the rules are stacked, even if they're possibly stacked in your favor. Okay. Now, this kind of came very clear to me when I started to follow research that was being done on primates. Okay. Did you know even animals demand to be treated fairly? Okay. This is what the new research is showing. Okay. And there was a fascinating study that I'll describe for you because it actually, whether the investigators realized it or not, is an experiment about international trade. Okay. All right, so here's our experiment. We have a big room and a bunch of monkeys in the room. The monkeys can all see one another. We have an investigator walk into the room, okay, and give each monkey a pile of rocks. Okay. And then we train the monkeys. If the monkey hands over a rock, we give the monkey a piece of cucumber. Okay. So this is trade. Okay. Monkey hands over a rock, they get cucumber. Rock, cucumber, rock, cucumber. Now, this is a really good deal if you're a monkey because you have no use for the rocks and the cucumbers are tasty. Okay? So to an economist, there's no reason for this trade to be disrupted. It seems to us that the monkey will want to continue trading in this economy. Okay? They're getting richer and richer and richer after all. So everybody's happy in our little trading economy until the investigator changes how they do things. Now, again, in full view of all the monkeys, the investigator starts to give some of the monkeys grapes instead of cucumbers in exchange for their rocks. But only a couple of the monkeys get grapes. Everybody else keeps getting cucumbers. Okay. Now, what we would say as economists who study trade is, it's all good, okay? Because everybody is still better off in this economy. Everybody's getting more and more to eat. We're all getting richer. Okay. The problem is that monkeys much prefer grapes to cucumbers. Okay. And so some of us are getting grapes, some of us are getting cucumbers, okay? The problem is, even though we're all getting richer, okay, maybe some of you have a prediction about what the monkeys might do in this case. If you were a monkey and you're getting cucumbers and you're watching your next-door neighbor get grapes, what might you do? You could maybe beat the monkey up. You could start to throw your rocks. But wait a minute, why would I throw my rocks? My rocks are worth food. Okay. But it turns out this is exactly what happened. The monkeys got very angry. They started to throw their rocks. They threw their rocks at the investigators. They also threw their rocks at the monkeys who were getting the grapes. Okay. The whole economy collapsed. Okay. The whole economy collapsed. Why did the whole economy collapse? Because there were a group of citizens in that economy who did not think they were being treated fairly. It's as simple as that. Okay? So, and this, again, I want to stress, is these were all winners in this economy. Okay? Everybody was getting richer. Okay? But even though they were all getting richer, they decided to become protesters, in effect, anti-trade protesters, because they didn't think this game was fair. And what we now know about human beings is that we are also, okay, very quick to give up our financial gains if we do not believe the process that is delivering these goods is fair. Okay? So do we want more and more and more cheaper and cheaper goods? Of course we do. But we also want to know that the trade arrangements that deliver these goods to us are fair. Okay? So I also think that much of the objection that we hear, much of the anti-trade sentiment that we hear, is not so much from the losers, if you will, but those who have reservations about the fairness of the process. So, for example, there are many practices that are common in China, where, of course, we have a very, very big trade deficit, that people don't think are fair. Okay? We have the currency that is kind of pegged or at an artificially low level. Okay? And there are people who think that's not fair. You should have a market exchange rate like the rest of us. In China, piracy and counterfeiting is rampant. Okay? That's viewed, at least in Washington, as cheating by some. It's not fair, even though maybe I'm a beneficiary and I have some of those counterfeit goods myself. There are a variety of different kinds of subsidies for state-owned industries. There are all kinds of corrupt practices in the various provinces of China. So if you listen to anti-trade sentiment and you listen carefully, often what you're hearing, okay, is really a condemnation about practices, particularly in China, but not only in China, where people think that the game is being won, if you will, because of unfair practices. Okay? So once again, we're not going to address that concern by compensating our factory workers. Now, I think a similar point about fairness applies to our burgeoning free trade agreements. We have dozens of free trade agreements now in the United States. We have NAFTA and we have CAFTA and we have trade agreements in South America. We have a new trade agreement with South Korea. We have a trade agreement with Australia. Okay? These are all called free trade agreements. The deal is supposed to be, with each agreement, trade between our partner in the agreement and the United States goes back and forth freely. So free trade agreements are supposed to lead to free trade. Okay? Well, that's not exactly how it works. I think a good example to understand how our free trade agreements work is to think about maybe tickets to a movie. Let's imagine that movie tickets cost $10. Okay? Anybody who wants to see the movie has to pay $10. Okay? Okay, fair enough. Now let's start signing free trade agreements. What might the movies look like then? Okay? Well, I'll tell you what it would look like. It would be something like, okay, students half price on Tuesdays. Senior citizens, you can come for $2 on Wednesday. Okay. On Thursday, everybody comes free if you're there before 5. Okay. So on and so forth. And we end up with a dozen free trade agreements for the movies, but actually trade is more complicated than it was before. Okay? This is, in my view, what we have done with our burgeoning free trade agreements. Okay? So we don't really have free trade with all of these different partners that we've signed these agreements with. We just have a different complicated set of rules for each country. Okay? And the problem, I think, is that these complicated sets of rules are written in a typically political way in Washington, with undue influence from certain industries or certain constituencies or what we like to call special interests. So if you look at a free trade agreement and if you really want a free trade agreement, then all you need is one piece of paper that says your goods can come this way and ours can go that way. But free trade agreements are like this high. Okay? There's this many rules that govern them, and it takes specialists to understand them, and they are really political creations. And so I think a lot of American citizens don't quite trust the process by which these rules came about, because the free trade agreements aren't really so much about liberalizing trade as they are about setting up special kinds of rules for certain interest groups. Okay? And I think, and this is, of course, no different than the criticism you hear about a lot of rulemaking in Washington. So when you hear protests or you hear arguments against things like NAFTA or CAFTA or the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, I don't actually think what you're hearing is arguments with trade. Okay? I think what you're hearing is arguments about the fairness of the process by which these rules are created. So, in summary, you know, there is no doubt that the traditional U.S. policy of compensating the losers, job retraining, enhanced safety nets, and so forth, these policies will help to dampen some of the Main Street concerns about international trade and globalization. Okay. And I absolutely agree that in order for a free trade agenda to move forward, we do have to protect those that have been harmed by liberalizing trade. Okay? So if we are talking about a textile town in North Carolina where the factory closed and the jobs all went to China, then of course that traditional policy response of protecting the losers is appropriate. Okay? But if I'm correct that a lot of anti-trade sentiment is coming from the winners because of concerns about the environment, about the process by which goods reach our shores, about the fairness of the underlying regime, then compensating the losers does not address those concerns. Okay. So in order to bring people on board who have these types of concerns, we need a much more creative and complicated policy response from our leaders in Washington, in Beijing, and in Brussels. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, while hopefully I'll get some questions from the audience here. Let me start with questions coming from the Thompson Scholars, from the students who are in that learning community. The first question is, how do we satisfy the current consumer mentality in a non-sweatshop world? To some extent, you dealt with that, I think, but perhaps you might want to elaborate.
Well, I think the internet age is partly taking care of that because information now is so instantaneous and companies are so afraid of tarnishing their reputation and their brand that they have a very strong economic incentive now to look out for labor conditions down deep into their supply chains. So I think there's a dual-prong approach. I think the companies are being pushed out of their own self-interest to clean up labor conditions in their supply chains. And, of course, as countries themselves become wealthier, they have a better capability to have their own enforcement mechanisms in place as well. Labor conditions in China right now in the apparel industry are astonishingly improved from what they were even just 10 years ago, I think as the result of both of those forces. Okay.
Okay, a second question from the Thompson Scholars. How can Africa balance their used clothing market with protecting their cotton production?
Okay. Well, I think that there are actually two different industries that we're talking about there. Their cotton agriculture industry, the main challenge that the cotton agriculture industry faces in West Texas are actually the cotton ag subsidies that we pay our cotton producers. And so, and the United States has been found in violation repeatedly over the past 10 years or so. Because of the extent of these subsidies, and the case has been brought by Brazil as well as West Africa. So there's no doubt that those big ag subsidies put the African growers at a disadvantage. In terms of the used clothing coming in, remarkably, even if you took away all the used clothing going into Africa, it would still be very, very difficult for Africans to develop a strong apparel industry, because it's the goods coming in from China that are actually undercutting them in terms of price. So the new clothing, much of the new clothing coming into Africa from China is actually priced below the used clothing coming in from the United States. And so Africa faces the same challenge as apparel producers everywhere, which is competing with China.
Okay. Can you give one or two examples of special interests served by present free trade agreements?
Sure. I could give you more than one or two. For example, CAFTA. Okay. The CAFTA free trade agreement allows, and I'm going to summarize again a stack of papers that's something like this high. The CAFTA free trade agreement allows apparel to come into the United States from the these Central American countries free of tariffs. Okay? So far, so good. But if you actually look at the law itself, how it's written and how it's enforced and how it was intended, the only way you can really get your apparel in from Central American countries into the United States tariff-free easily is if that clothing is made of fabric produced in the United States. Okay? So what you have here is a rule that's protecting U.S. fabric producers, at the same time really limiting the ability of the Central American countries to develop their own textile industry. They would be able to sell us much more clothing if they could source their fabric, you know, from India or China or Pakistan, but they really can't. So you have a free trade agreement there that's really that was written in a way to protect the U.S. Textile producers.
Thank you. If it is so that free passage of resources and products across borders in general benefits most people, might it follow that free passage of workers across borders would also benefit the most people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But of course, we have free passage of goods, free passage mostly of services, and very limited free passage of people. And that, from the standpoint of economic growth, okay, is a bad policy.
With all the complex issues, how can the U.S. economy regain its former glories without a strong manufacturing base?
Well, it's interesting. You know, manufacturing employment is actually up this past month. There's two things happening simultaneously in the United States. Manufacturing employment is on a fairly steady, long-run decline since the end, since not too long after World War II, okay? Up maybe into the 60s and 70s into some industries. So we've had some blips. As I said, last month, manufacturing employment was up, but pretty much the employment in manufacturing has been at a relatively steady decline. However, and that's, of course, what you hear on the news, what you don't hear is that manufacturing output has been steadily increasing for that entire period. So what is happening is that we are producing more and more and more with fewer and fewer workers. Okay? And that is because, first of all, our technology is advancing at such a rapid rate, but it's also because our workers are increasingly more productive. So it's a fallacy that we are that we're no longer manufacturing. It is true that we're losing manufacturing employment, but that's because the manufacturing that we are doing in the United States is very capital intensive, very high tech, and just requires fewer workers.
Let me try to reduce to a shorter question, a much more lengthy question. And the essence of it, I think, if I read it correctly, is how do you ensure that international trade can be sustainable, to create a kind of equilibrium in the global economy that is sustainable over the long run?
I don't think you do. I mean, I think that any system, we've never had a sustainable global economy, and I don't think we ever will, because it changes too quickly. Okay? So, for example, if you look at Japan's dominance in the 1980s, people would say, well, is this world order sustainable? And the answer is no. But that doesn't mean that we should take some sort of active policy action against Japan. Okay? All by itself, an economic system is so dynamic that no one pattern will be sustained. So I think that, for example, the challenges right now that we face in our trade relationship with China and the challenges that China faces internally mean that the status quo is not going to be sustainable. And so some other trading relationship will rise up. I don't think we're going to be able to design some sort of system from the top that we call sustainable.
Let's end with this question. Do you agree there is a conflict between the goals of economists who see free trade as a process leading to efficiency and low prices, and our government leaders whose priorities are more on the process and preserving American jobs?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, what economists can do is talk about what they believe are the best economic policies. But economic policies do not trump all other interests or all other kinds of policies. So there is no doubt that the members of Congress need to consider other points of view, other values, other metrics besides economic growth when formulating our public policy. So the economists, I think, would like to be heard, but we actually don't want to always be obeyed. Yeah.
You've been listening to a program from the E. N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E. N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today's guest speaker was Pietra Rivoli, a professor at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University, where she teaches finance and international business in the undergraduate, graduate, and executive programs. The topic of her talk was, Who's Afraid of International Trade? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 12, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E. N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.